Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the program this week. My guest is Mayor Todd Barton of Crawfordsville, and we'd love to have your questions for him during the next half an hour. You can always call those in to area code 765-496-1999. You can send emailed questions to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm very good. Thank you.
Thanks, as always, for being on the show. Let me get right down to it. We reported a little bit this week on the NDOT meeting that happened in your city regarding those community crossings grants that we've been reporting about. Those are for, you know, road and bridge improvements. And I remembered that you told me on the program a couple of months ago that in some cases you're a little skeptical of NDOT meetings, particularly ones that are supposed to be sort of listening sessions. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on how this one went.
Well, I don't think this was designed as a listening session. I think it was an informational session for us to learn what adjustments had been made to the program, what this legislature had adjusted and what they hadn't, and what we needed to do moving forward to attempt to participate in this program. So this wasn't really a meeting designed for us to give feedback. More, it was just designed for us to get information. So I you saw that one-way flow of information. Certainly, they took questions and those kind of things, but the program has already been created, and it is what it is at this point.
And you got some money from it last year. You're planning to apply again this year. Do you think it'll be any harder this year to justify to the state why your ideas should be fully funded versus others?
I think it will. I think you'll see more people apply this year, more communities apply, because they've had more time to get their asset management plan together and think through some of these things. So there'll be more competition, but, you know, obviously when you've been awarded money to double back, you have to, I think, make a very compelling case. I'm convinced we can do that, but we have to think about our approach and think about the priorities that we've created.
And one of the things that our reporter, Charlotte Tuggle, who covered the story, said was that you said was that you would kind of notice there was a little more paperwork this time around.
Well, this program was originally designed to be as simple as possible and not really follow that mechanism that you follow when you receive federal highway money, because that is a very bureaucratic, cumbersome process. And they tried to really streamline this and make it as simple as it could possibly be. Unfortunately, what we see and what we heard in the meeting the other day was they are bringing some of those steps back to this process. And that's very unfortunate. And I understand why. I mean, they made it very clear they've had communities around the state that try to circumvent the process and cut corners and just do things that they shouldn't be doing. And a lot of times they're just not paying attention. They just, you know, try to blow through this and not really crossing their T's and dot their I's. So sadly, the rest of us pay the price when a few people do that. And so we do see some regulatory steps creeping back into this process.
So you're saying it's not malfeasance on the part of the other cities so much as it is just lack of attention to detail.
Right, exactly. I don't think anyone's, you know, trying to deceive anyone. They're just not paying attention to, you know, the bidding process and the rules as they're laid out when they're awarded the money. It's all in black and white. You know what you need to do, but unfortunately some don't follow those.
How do you keep track of all of those tiny little tenets of what you're able to do with the money, what you're not able to do with the money? I mean, how do you, when you get cash like this, make sure that you are completely on the up and up with everything that goes on?
Well, we build several layers into the system for us. I mean, obviously, I'm watching it, and then I have a street commissioner who really pays attention to detail and is really watching the program guidance and making sure we're staying within those bounds. We also have the clerk treasurer who's obviously watching the financial piece of this and making sure that how we're doing this and how we're flowing this money fits with the requirements the state has put on us, and we know that this will be audited by the State Board of Accounts. That's a given. So we kind of all watch different pieces of this and build in several layers, and we all get together and talk and discuss it and to make sure it's laid out properly.
Do you feel like this is more competitive this year? I mean, you mentioned that more and more people probably are going to be applying for these. So do you feel that this year there's more pressure that your proposal, whatever it may be, has to actively be better than that from other cities so that you stand a chance of getting all the money you want to get?
I'm not sure. I think it's too early to tell. If you looked at the attendance at the meeting, the room was full for two different sessions. So that tells you this district, there's a lot of interest. But you don't know, you know, really if all those people will end up submitting or not submitting. Last year we saw a big turnout for the meeting and you know, there wasn't, you know, but a fraction of those communities actually turned in applications. So it's too early to tell. Everybody hears there's money and they show up to the meeting, and then when it comes time to really sharpen your pencil and put your nose to the grindstone and put together a competitive proposal, you see people start to kind of fall out. So time will tell.
It was interesting to me to look at the graph of how much money is expected to be in this program, because it is a finite amount of money every year from the state. And it was expected to go down by about 50% from what it was a year ago. And then 2 years from now, it's expected to be kind of twice that amount of money. And so it's this interesting roller coaster curve of how much money is there. Do you think that'll affect what the state does with the cash and who gets it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when they have a finite amount of resources, they're going to have to make tough decisions about how they allocate those resources. And some communities will get things awarded and other communities will not. That's a tough position for the state, I'm sure, but they will have to adjust it up and down based on that income. There's no doubt about that.
So now we've got these community crossings grants, and we've got a new infrastructure bill at the state that's designed to raise more than $1 billion a year, hopefully for the next 20 years, just to keep roads and bridges the way they are. There's a little bit of cash in the state budget proper for roads. Give me your assessment, if you would, of how the state is actually doing for local communities trying to maintain the roads and the bridges and the other infrastructure that you have. Do you think there is enough money out there now? Has there been enough money allocated to do all that you need to do, saying nothing of doing everything you might want to do?
Well, I don't know that we are 100% where we need to be yet. I will say that I think this is a huge step forward in the right direction, but the job's not done. We need to think about this long term, and probably going to have to make some more adjustments. And you know, it really comes down to a mindset and beliefs and everything else. And we tout ourselves as the crossroads of America, but for many years, we've ignored our infrastructure, and our position as a crossroads is really at risk because the infrastructure is crumbling while we are, you know, either sitting on a surplus or, you know, all these different things. So, you know, we're going to have to think about it the long haul, but it is absolutely a step in the right direction, and I applaud the legislature. I know I don't do that often, but I do applaud them in this case for at least taking the initial steps to point us down that path.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. We'd love to have your questions for him. Please call 765-496-1999. Email ask@wbaa.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. I was talking to Chris McBarnes on this program last week about Frankfort kind of putting the squeeze to some homeowners who are not keeping their properties in good shape. And I see where your community has actually begun to start charging people when they neglect to mow their lawns and city crews have to go do it for them. Is that right?
We've done that for many years. Yes, that's nothing new for us.
So you've already identified a few of these properties. I mean, how many would you estimate there are in total this time around?
Well, that's an ongoing process that code enforcement works on. And I think any given week, you know, at this time of year, we're approving anywhere from 5 to 12, 13, 14 properties each time. You know, a few years ago, we went back and adjusted that fee to create a realistic fee for what it really cost us to send those city crews in there with a mower to do this work. And then a lien is placed on those properties. And you hope at some point you start to recover what the other taxpayers have had to invest in cleaning that property up. So it's an ongoing process. You know, there are quite a few in this community that do not receive the attention they need to receive. And many times, not always, but many times those are out-of-town property owners or situations in which people have walked away and it's in transition, maybe it's in foreclosure, and we have to step in and keep those mowed and cleaned up because it's simply not a good situation for those around those properties, for the other neighbors to have to deal with that.
I was talking with Mayor McBarnes last week about a couple of properties in his city that have taken 6 years worth of talking to before anything really got done. And so let me ask you, how many times do you notify somebody that this is going to happen to them? How long does that process take before you actually step in?
Well, we follow the state statute, which gives them, and I don't know the exact numbers, but I think it's, you know, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks notice they receive that there is a problem. with the grass or, you know, stump and mow, those kinds of things. And then we go through the process of the Board of Works authorizing this action to be taken. So I know there is a number. I believe it's 2 weeks, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But we follow that procedure. So they do have plenty of warning. This is not something that, you know, we just say, hey, your grass is about an inch too high. We're going to come out and mow your yard. That doesn't happen. These are cases that have been in the system, and we're well familiar with those. And it's obvious, you know, we serve notice, we don't get anything back, and nothing happens, then we step in and take care of it. I do think an advantage we have is that we really try a multi-prong approach to this. And so we don't have properties, you know, lingering for 6 years, 5 years, those kinds of things. We might deal with it for a year or two, but by then, between all the different layers that we can bring to bear, we can tend to make something happen with this property and move it forward.
Just so I'm clear, is this any sort of a revenue generator for you? Are you allowed to, or do you charge more than what it costs for the personnel and the maintenance equipment to do that work?
I'm not sure if we are legally allowed to charge more. We don't. In our case, we're simply trying to recover the costs that we're expending to go out and clean those properties up.
On to other things. We noticed there have been obviously quite a few strong storms here in West Central Indiana. A lot of communities have had issues with flooding. So I wanted to ask you, I noticed that Montgomery County and Crawfordsville were certainly not immune to that. Did the city notice any trouble spots that perhaps you were not aware of, or you were not as aware as they were? You weren't aware as that they are as bad as they are?
Well, I think it was the inverse for us this time. Certainly we had some trouble spots. And we had one or two that, you know, those were new, that we had never seen an issue there before. But what we noticed this time is that some of the work that we've done over the last couple of years is actually starting to pay off. So, you know, the East College Street area, those folks stayed dry and their homes were getting flooded before. West Main, we've put all new storm sewer through there and catch basins. They were much better off this time than they have been in the past. So Southside Drive, another example, we're seeing some significant progress in draining the water out of these neighborhoods. Again, you know, decades of not really addressing those things, and we're trying to catch up. So not entirely done. We still have some neighborhoods with some issues. We have some more work planned for this summer. But I think this rainfall, or these events that we saw recently, kind of gave us some positive feedback that we're doing the right things.
As you're looking at these infrastructure grants through community crossings and lots of other things, do the recent rains help you reprioritize which of your projects you think need to be done first, especially as you notice things you may not have seen before?
Well, I don't know that the recent rains have really done that. I think we have a pretty good handle on what kind of issues we have. And we're really dealing with the bigger things, so we kind of already were aware of those. The things that have surfaced recently tend to be smaller issues that we're not dealing with grants. We can go in and, you know, maybe install one new inlet or two new inlets and kind of take care of on our own. So I don't think that the storms really changed our plan any. We kind of have that in place and are moving forward with it.
On to another topic. You had a police officer recently who was charged with falsifying records after he allegedly erased some dashboard camera video that may have shown him crashing his squad car into someone's ornamental brick sidewalk. And then it's alleged that he left a forged note in that homeowner's mailbox with some money for repairs, but signed the note as though he were an immigrant worker. How have you been dealing with this?
Well, you know, obviously in a case like this, this is an ongoing case, and everyone is, you know, innocent until proven guilty. So I can't comment on whether or not the officer did these things or did not. But I will say that, you know, the very moment we're made aware that there's a concern with any of our officers, I'm very proud of our police department and administration for stepping forward and initiating an investigation, calling in the state police as soon as they realized that there was a concern here. There was a valid concern. They brought in an outside agency and really moved that forward. So, you know, I hope what the public takes away from this, we all know that you know, majority of our officers are doing an amazing job. You're going to have some bad things happen here and there. That's unfortunate. We do everything we can to prevent that. But if something does go awry, I think the public can take comfort in the fact that in our department and in our city, We don't turn a blind eye to things. We make sure it gets investigated. Every officer wears a body camera that was instrumental in this particular instance, and we take those things seriously.
To your knowledge, is this officer still on the force?
No, this officer has resigned.
So I wondered, will this prompt the chief or some other executive, perhaps even you, having a talk with those officers remaining on the force about proper conduct? Is this a time to remind them of things they should probably already know and be following?
Well, that's certainly a decision I'll leave up to the police chief, and I know he has a feel for whether or not that's needed. I don't think that I have an adequate assessment of that, but again, I'll go back to the fact that we have great officers doing absolutely great work in the face of some really difficult, trying situations. They're all well-trained and really understand their role, so I don't think there's any misunderstanding on anybody's part, you know, where that line is and where you shouldn't cross that line. Unfortunately, you'll have somebody who works into the system that just is not meant for this line of work and does not have the character issues that are required. And I'm very proud of the fact that if our department senses that through the training program, they work it out. And a lot of people don't make it through that. You know, we have officers who are hired who may even go to the academy and graduate and don't get through the field training program or don't get through their first year or two simply because it's so intense and the scrutiny is so high. So I don't know that anybody needs to give them a lecture, if you will. They know what they need to be doing and not doing.
This brings up an aspect of body cameras and dashboard cameras that I haven't discussed much with public officials, and that's how cities maintain the integrity of that footage. Because, again, the allegation in this case is that this officer may have tampered with the dash cam video or the body cam video. So how do you make sure that footage is not tampered with, erased, doctored in some way? What processes are in place to ensure that?
Well, I don't know that I can answer the specific questions about the exact procedure, but I do know we have safeguards in place, especially the body cam footage, that it cannot be altered. It cannot be, you know, no one can go in and change that or delete something, and so I think that's a very good thing. My understanding is the dash cam is a little more challenging from a technical standpoint, but I do know that our police department is really working on that in light of this particular case to make sure they're closing every loophole that might exist that would allow somebody to tamper with that evidence. And of course, in the end, tampering with evidence is a felony. So officers know that, and if they choose to do that, they're taking a very, very big risk.
Will this prompt the city to keep a closer eye either on its public safety employees or on the procedures that they use to monitor how those people are doing their jobs? Is there any sort of a reassessment there that you're thinking will go on?
Well, I know there's a reassessment within the police department, but again, I think in this particular case, it was a validation that the system that's in place is working very well. Several things happened in this case. In which alarms were triggered that showed me that we're doing the right things and the department's doing the right things, the city's doing the right things, fellow officers are doing the right things. And when there's a potential problem, we know about it. So I think it was a validation, but certainly there's always going to be a reassessment after something happens.
We've got about 10 minutes left with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton on Ask the Mayor today here on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the program. If you'd like to get your questions in for the mayor, please call 765-496-1999, email ask@WBAA.org, or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, let's talk about something else that happened this week. You and I have talked before about your conversations with the railroads whose lines run through your city, and earlier this week, a train derailed, snarled traffic for hours. Have you had a chance to be in contact with anyone from CSX about how or why that happened?
Yes, I have, and I think the news coverage might have made that a little bigger than it was. It was actually on one of our side streets, so there wasn't really much of a traffic impact with that particular incident, and it was resolved within, you know, 3 or 4 hours probably at the most. You know, you have one locomotive with a wheel or two off of the track, and they simply raise that back up and put it on. But much bigger picture is that that line, which is the east-west line, is in very, very bad shape. And it's part of the overall puzzle that we're working through to get that line actually eliminated. And this probably forces the issue more than anything to date. CSX has taken that line out of service. So we're really working with the customer at the end of that line, local industry, to get them in another facility over on the main rail line and just totally eliminate that rail itself. So that gets, once that happens, that eliminates 13 rail crossings in our community, 13 crossings that are in really bad shape, hassle.
You would just tear that rail up.
Yeah, we'd come out, and eventually our goal is, through Stellar, to put a trail on that particular rail line. So we've been working through that. This is nothing new. This probably just kind of speeds the issue up.
In an odd way, did you need something like this to happen to convince the railroads that the infrastructure in your city is, in some cases, in bad shape and may need more attention than has been paid to it?
Well, I don't know that we needed to convince the railroad. They knew. Where we need the help is convincing local industry. You know, as we're working through moving them off of this line, in the end, it comes down to dollars and cents. And, you know, how much are they willing to contribute to be a good neighbor, I guess, in a sense. So it does kind of push things a little on them to say, okay, this is, we can't go along with status quo anymore. That's not going to work. The railroad has really been on our side in saying this line is not safe. We don't want to continue this. We need to get out of here as soon as possible. So it is going to move it forward from the aspect of really prompting the local industry to move forward more quickly than they probably would have.
It strikes me this is kind of about different companies' bottom lines, whether it's the railroad not being able to move its products that it's carrying as fast as it wants to or as fast as customers would demand. And then it's about the industries in your community who are at the end of the line who need to get those end products by rail to them so they can make whatever it is that they make. And so have you begun approaching either the railroad or the industries and saying, hey, we're going to start this pool of money to help with some, even maybe something big like railroad relocation, or maybe something small like let's take it one piece of track at a time?
Well, we're already into that. We are really about 3 years into that conversation, and you know, the irony is we are so close to having this done and put together. This just speeds the process up. Maybe it'll push it over the hump, if you will. But we've been having that conversation for a long time. You have to really find the benefits for industry, the benefits for the rail line, and the benefits for the city, and kind of put those all together and try to offset any potential costs. But, you know, in doing that, we have brought some significant incentives to the table to lower the cost of this industry building a new warehouse on the east side. You know, we pulled all that to the table. We are looking at ways to participate in that development that will help lower the cost. Ultimately, we have to structure a deal that they can take back to their corporate boss, if you will, in that structure, and convince them that this is a good move corporate-wise for their Crawfordsville facility. And we are very close on that. We're not there yet, but we're closer than we've ever been.
Are you saying you've got a pot of money set aside for railroad relocation that you've begun to fill?
Well, it's not really a railroad relocation as much as it is eliminating a line, and we won't have to financially participate in that. Where you get into the tough stuff is putting new switches on the existing line and building a new warehouse and doing some of those things. And we certainly are willing to step up to the table to make that happen. And there's, you know, we've brought legal counsel on board to help us through that scenario. As you build a new warehouse and you have tax income from that, you can think about how you start using that to maybe work on some of this infrastructure. So we are crafting that, and we're pretty close with it.
I think of some of the lines. I mean, you've got one that the Amtrak train crosses as you head east out of downtown there, and you know that's a freight line as well. I mean, it would be much easier if you could, for instance, build an overpass there and let the trains go by unencumbered. Is that at all something you're thinking of doing either there or anywhere else in the city, or do you think that just getting rid of a few of the lines will be enough?
Well, Well, I think it's going to take a combination of those things. And getting rid of the east-west line really doesn't cause traffic problems or solve any traffic problems. It eliminates the rough crossings. The traffic problems come from that north-south, what's previously known as the Monon line, where you have three state highways bottlenecked together, crossing right there. Our rail blockages are down considerably thanks to the automated switching gear that's put in place that's satellite controlled. The last few weeks we did have an issue because that crossing was closed and they rebuilt the crossing. So, we had an inconvenience there. And that was a very frustrating process. And it's hard to understand, the way the rail companies work, because you see the crossing closed and nothing happens, and they might tear it out and it might sit for a few more days. And that's very frustrating. It's very frustrating for the residents who are inconvenienced, and it's very frustrating for us. And I know NDOT was leaning on them heavily, but long term, a grade separation or an overpass there is really the best solution. We just have to be realistic in how we approach that. And people have to understand that those are state highways. The state of Indiana will have to step forward and make that happen. That's only going to occur if we, as local citizens, put pressure on our legislators to help fund it. And it can be done. It can absolutely be done. It just has to become a priority for the state of Indiana.
Well, it's back to the conversations we've had about whether rail is indeed a priority. And you and I have talked primarily on this show about passenger rail, but it would seem like for a state that wants to position itself as business friendly, as Indiana and its lawmakers are always all too ready to do, is this something that's falling by the wayside as being something business friendly that they could do more of?
I'm not sure it's falling by the wayside. I think they're addressing it quite well in some communities. It just goes back to one of those instances in which the communities that are making the most noise are getting the attention. And, for many years I've heard NDOT say, we can't afford to put an overpass there. It's too expensive. But yet I drive to some of these other communities and I see a grade separation every block, So you can afford one bridge in Crawfordsville. We just have not been on their radar as a priority. And for many years, I really don't like to say this, but it's absolutely true. The state of Indiana and NDOT has passed this off as a local problem. A train's blocking Crawfordsville, that's terrible. The city should do something. They're state highways, They need to step forward and fix this traffic problem that they've created in our community. So I think we're making some headway there. I think we finally have the attention of our state legislators, and they finally see it as a legitimate, serious issue. It will take many years to solve, but at least they're paying attention, and it will only occur if our legislators deem it a priority and put pressure on their legislators or on the NDOT to make this happen.
Well, and certainly your community is not the only place where that's happening. I've heard it in Terre Haute and other places, and then you've got places like Greater Lafayette, where it took 20 years to do a railroad relocation.
Right.
So I expect this may be something you and I talk about on future shows.
Very good.
Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time. We'll talk to you again next month.
Thank you.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, you can always send questions at any time for any of our four mayors to ask@WBAA.org. You can tweet questions at WBAA News on Twitter, and you can find all of these shows archived at our website. That's WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.